Before you listen to this great episode of Partner with Survivor, we'd just like to tell you about a powerful new practice tool the Safe and Together Institute has launched. Our perpetrator pattern mapping tool has been available for 10 years, but now it's available for the first time in a web-based version. What it does is really help you map perpetrators' patterns of behavior onto child family functioning, talk about its intersections with mental health, substance abuse, and other issues, address intersectionalities, worker safety, all in an easy-to-use online package that protects the confidentiality of your information and lets you wrap it all up in a neat little package, basically, to print it out and to kind of document all those different pieces of information. This is a tool that can be used by both survivors and practitioners. And for the very first time, it's available immediately online without any other prior training.
The training is embedded in this powerful practice tool so that teams that have not been trained in Safe and Together can immediately begin mapping in an effective way.
That's right. It's like having a Safe and Together coach in your back pocket is what I like to say.
There you go.
So we really encourage you to go to our virtual academy, academy.safeandtogetherinstitute.com. Check it out. You know, you can subscribe to it immediately or you can check out a free demo version for 30 days. So please reach out to us and try this new tool. Now enjoy this great episode of Partner with Survivor. And we're back.
We are back.
Yes. And you're listening to Partner with a Survivor. Welcome back, everybody. And I'm David Mandel, the CEO of the Safe and Together Institute.
And I'm Ruth Raimondo Mandel, and I am the Communications and E-Learning Manager.
And we are joining you from Tunxus Land here in, I want to say sunny Connecticut, but it is so far from not sunny. It is not sunny at all. And it's gray and drizzly and whatever it is here. And but we just want to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land, the Tunxus people, and just acknowledge any elders, indigenous elders, past, present, emerging, who may be listening to us. So we are in our second show of this season, and we are very excited to have Lisa Young-Lorantz with us, Dr. Lisa Young-Lorantz. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be talking about her work around women's use of force and related things. And I think just to contextualize for people who know the Safe and Together model, that we're, you know, when we talk about this issue of coercive control and domestic violence, we look at it from a both and lens, that it's a gendered issue. And at the same time, it has to be, the model has to look at scenarios where women use force against men, and it's a problem when it's violence and coercive control in same-sex relationships. Mm-hmm. When one of the partners or both are trans. And so it's just the model is behavioral and objective in that way. And at the same time, gender matters in lots of ways. And
right. Well, the way that we often word it is that anybody can use violence. Anybody has the potential to use violence and control as a strategy for relationship. Poor strategy, by the way, poor long-term strategy, but that currently the reality is that the most harm and danger faced has a gendered lens.
That's right.
And that many people still ignore the violence of males as a fundamental threat to the well-being, integrity, and freedom of individuals and the cohesion of families.
And so over the years, the model has been sensitive at the same time to women's use of violence. And I'm really interested. I've known Lisa for a long time, and I'm really interested in welcoming her to the show. So Lisa, please join us, and thank you so much for being on the podcast with us.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here.
No, I'm going to just read your bio a little bit. And I know people can get uncomfortable, you know, with bios, but I think people should know your background, and because you're an amazing researcher and practitioner, you come with a tremendous amount of experience. So Lisa Young-Lorantz has a PhD, a master's in social work, is licensed as a clinical social worker, has extensive direct practice experience serving the needs of people who have survived and caused harm in their relationships. And Lisa, I really appreciate it as somebody who was a practitioner themselves, just that kind of that scope of practitioner whether researcher or author or trainer, that really adds a lot to it. And she's a pioneer in the anti-violence intervention field. Dr. Young-Lorance continues to shape innovative community and prison-based services for diverse violence-involved women. Her scholarship explores topics at the intersection of intimate partner violence, gender, sexuality, criminalization, race, and intervention, while centering the experiences of legal and child protection system involved women who have survived and caused harm in their intimate relationships. The goal of Dr. Young-Lorance's work is to dismantle systems of oppression by partnering with individuals, organizations, and communities to advance the well-being of vulnerable people. And her work has been published in numerous journals, and she's currently teaching at the Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research at Bryn Mawr College. So again, welcome, and thank you for joining us. So I really just want to kick it off by just asking you to talk about your origin story in some ways around your research into women's use of force.
Yes, thank you. So my origin story into research actually takes place many years before, and you'll learn in our time together that I'm all about context. So it's never as easy as a short answer. I started this work back in the late 90s, early 2000s. This work meaning being part of the lives of people who experienced intimate harm and also used that harm. So I was working at Jersey Battered Women's Services in Morris County, New Jersey, and I was co-facilitating community outreach program groups. So what that meant was that in these particular groups, it was cisgender women, majority of them heterosexual, who had survived abuse by their partner, and they were not in emergency shelter, and some of them were out of the relationship, some of them were in the relationship. All of them were seeking support. So they would come to groups either during the day or in the evening. And through that process, build connection, learn, and also really have an opportunity to explore next steps. Now, during that process, women were also talking about feeling that they had they were really out of options in terms of how to navigate their relationships. So some of them were starting to navigate the abuse against them by fighting back and using resistive violence. Others were thinking about using forms of physical harm to resist either coercive control or physical violence or a whole range of harm. Now, what was happening across our state, as with what was happening across the nation, was the impact of mandatory preferred for arrest law legislation, meaning that when the police arrived at the scene of an incident, they were tasked with really the obligation to have to identify who the person was that caused the harm, meaning the perpetrator, the offender, and then the person who was the victim of that harm. And we were concerned in the state of New Jersey what the implications were around the people that we were serving. So in Jersey Battered Women's Service, we also had an ACT program, so Abuse Ceases Today. And that is a program for, traditionally, it's been called the Battering Intervention Program in the U.S. and in Australia, Men's Behavior Change Program. And I was working in that program as well. So as we're grappling with this issue of mandatory arrest, knowing that these things are happening and a lot of funding is tied to that, women in the groups were talking about what they were doing to navigate their harm and their relationships. And during our clinical supervision, there was concern about how do we serve the needs of women who are disclosing that they're using harm, given that this is a victim service organization? Now, this is my introduction as a practitioner to what I now refer to as the victim-offender binary, meaning in the U.S. context and many other places around the world, that once your typically systems identified as either one, there's a protocol for what happens next. In the U.S. context, if you are systems identified, meaning by from the legal system, as a survivor, or as a victim, and with legal language, then you are encouraged to go to voluntary, free supportive services and get a range of resources. As long as you also, this is another important part of it, are a good survivor, a survivor who's easy to work with, typically has certain identities and income, and is seen by the system as a good mother or deserving of those services. Okay. So as this process was going forward, I was part of a state coalition subcommittee on women's use of force. And as a domestic violence agency, we were talking about these things statewide. What do we do? Because women were starting to be court ordered to anti-violence intervention or court ordered to battering intervention. So programming traditionally designed for serving men, cisgender, heterosexual men who were using power and control in their relationships. We were worried about that because we knew that it is potentially re-victimizing to send people to services that are not designed for them, mm-hmm. and it's ineffective. So what happened was, as time went on, increase of women coming and asking for help. And so asking for help would be, for example, a woman calling me and saying, I've been arrested on domestic violence charges. It's not so long ago that I've dropped a restraining order after having my jaw broken. I fought back. I need a place to go because if I don't have one, I will then go to jail. And all I could do at that point was to say, I'm sorry, we don't have a place for you. Our leadership was incredible at Jersey Battered Women's Services, really thinking outside the box in terms of what we could do to serve the needs of people who were not getting the help that they needed.
So then, go ahead. I've got tons of things right through my head. Go ahead. Finish.
My thermometer went up a couple of times.
I could see that. Finish your groundwork here. We had the opportunity then to create what is called the VISTA program. So it's not an acronym. It means an extended view. And in August of 2002, started the first group, serving the complex needs of women who had used force in their relationships and typically were court ordered for domestic violence charges and then convictions. And this was one of the first formal programs in the U.S., although at this time I was certainly not alone in that work, but it was very isolating work. From that, then, I started doing to writing about it and publishing about what I was seeing as a practitioner and what many of the opportunities for growth were in the system, what people were missing in terms of the context and the needs of the people in the room. So that's how I got started as a researcher.
I'll say something that Ruth, you wrote, which is so much of these stories are about system driven needs or challenges, yeah. Right? And I remember, just reminds you of something I thought about years ago. I started my work in men's behavior change, but in domestic violence work with perpetrators in Connecticut. After the law was changed in 1986, and those original groups were 6 weeks long and they were co-ed. And I was part of a group of people who said, that's not acceptable. You have to separate. We drew a line and said, we're not going to take women into the same group as men. And we actually changed, as a service provider, we changed the state's policy. So eventually mm-hmm. they created women's groups and men's groups, which were very different. I mean, yeah. so we were right there in those early years, but it's an issue. You're very clear that is driven by the system and what the system needs and how the system labels people. Yeah. And that's often focused on an instant, the incident or the instant offensive, it's called in the criminal justice system. And it's a snapshot model, yep. as well.
Yes. Well, cranky survivor over here, asking a person who's living in coercive control and domestic violence to not respond to that violence ever and to just take it and never to resist is asking them to just lay down and allow themselves to be abused. And we have assumed in our systems of care, this is not about system liability, this is about assumptions, that male violence is a right of men, that it's a natural state of men, that we need to be understanding when they use violence, that we need to help them. But we have not ever looked at women and said, what is the context of the violence? How is this arising? Is this an act of self-defense? And the legal measures, which really are leaned upon for arrest about violence between people, exist outside of the context of the family.
Yes.
Because quite frankly, the assumption is that men have the right to use violence if it's deemed as preserving the relationship, which it doesn't, by the way, it doesn't preserve the relationship. It only preserves the relationship if women are entrapped and they can't leave. It's deemed as being a teaching tool. She was cheating, therefore I beat her. Or she was cheating, therefore I put cameras all around the house and locked the doors and kept her in at night. And these are things that are still said today to law enforcement officers who say, oh, that sounds reasonable.
I want to turn it back to you in a second, Lisa, to find out some of the things you learned as you ran these groups. It reminds me, you're obviously familiar with the Catch-22 language, and it's something that's in your lexicon, you know, but sort of women who you look at women who don't fight back and say, why don't they stand up for themselves?
Right.
And then when they do stand up for themselves, why'd she provoke him? You know, why did she?
Or she's violent.
Yeah, or she's violent. And then you get into issues of racialization and racism and mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. So anyway, so it's such a big issue. So tell us a little bit about what you learned about some of the, because I agree about context. You said context, you know, mm-hmm. about what's different and what's similar about women's use of violence in intimate relationships and men's use of violence, or just what you learned about the nature of it.
Mm-hmm. Anytime that I have a question like that, to me, it's always fundamentally important to go back to the words and experiences of the people who've taught me. And those are the women in the room, in the group, mm-hmm. and also in my research. And in research as a practitioner, and also now research for my doctoral dissertation, I spent 3 years with 33 women who were part of an anti-violence intervention program because of their use of force or alleged use of force. And what I have learned is not only how important context is, but how important their intersectional identities are, particularly around race, sexual identities, and income. Mm-hmm. And typically the women who would get court ordered to a program that I ran or programs that I provide guidance and support programs in Victoria, Australia. It is typically low-income women of diverse identities, whether it's immigrant, whether it's their English is not their first language, whatever it may be, where their situations are really weaponized against them mm-hmm. in ways that only contribute to the harm. So with your question, David, when you asked about, you know, learning about context in terms of differences, I want to know more about that. Are you speaking about in group?
I think about just in terms of, well, it could be about how they talk about it in group, how they understand it. Mm-hmm. But I'm also thinking about some of the basic things that I've seen in terms of dynamics. I'll give you an example. And it's not about violence per se, but it's about fighting back. And it's a case where, you know, somebody took their child and left the state. Mm-hmm. And when the legal ruling came down, it happened to be a case that we'd worked on and put a lot of effort into showing the court the context of coercive control and pattern of violence of the partner. Mm-hmm. And the justice who ruled on it said, well, her fleeing the state is a logical protective behavior given what was coming at her and her son. Mm-hmm. And so the perpetrator's behavior, the dad's behavior, gave context
to what otherwise might have been labeled absconding or kidnapping. So it's not violence per se, but it's that we understand, and in the work we do, we say, look, the perpetrator's pattern has to be identified first. Because without that, the way you look at victims' decision-making cannot be contextualized.
I think there's a piece missing, actually. Yeah. And the piece missing is that judge's rubric should have included not just the behaviors of the perpetrator, but what was available to that victim at that time as an intervention.
That's right.
What actually stopped or prevented the violence coming at them.
Right.
What were professionals doing? What was the system doing? What were they capable of?
Right.
And what were they not capable of? And if we're not capable of intervening in those type of situations in any material way, which actually creates safety, then the logical response and the thing that we would ask any mother to do would be to protect their child. Right. And all of us should laud that person for doing that. And then at that point, that's when we as professionals need to look at ourselves and say, how are we going to improve this so that person has some material concrete supports and interventions that do create safety?
Mm-hmm. You know, regarding that and how, you know, the context around that, it was a frustration of mine a few years ago around this idea, you know, of course, we need certain generalizations and categories to be able to get through the day. Otherwise, you know, I prefer to talk behaviorally and over the lifespan, and I know, but we also have to get through the day. So this topic and this language of women's use of force or women's use of violence was frustrating to me because I know there's not one woman and I know there's not one form of force and what that looked like. So I partnered with Susan Miller, who is a professor of criminology at University of Delaware. And we looked at the intake documents of over 280 women in terms of how they described the incident that led to their arrest. And so we were able to parse out what this, you know, a woman's use of force and what's the context of that around that. And yes, very diverse. We came up with 9 different themes around that, and to be able to give us certainly not a stopping point, but very much a starting point to understand how complex this is and what people do in order to take care of themselves. And also, there are women who use force based on, you know, unresolved trauma histories, mm-hmm. and to navigate current relationships where their partner is not harming them. And mm-hmm. so if we let that trauma go unaddressed, that's when there's a huge risk to everyone involved.
Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting, you know, I want to hear about the themes in a minute, but, you know, just to be able to land in, and I think folks who really think about this through a gendered lens and think about the you know, men's use of violence and how it's connected to other forms of patriarchy and sexism and violence against women, but to feel comfortable saying, period, there are women who use force in unjustified and unacceptable ways. That's not self-defense, and they exist, and that's real. And I mean, I'm thinking about an example again that I, and again, we would use in the practice work we do, we use patterns of behaviors to be discriminatory in terms of, you know, differential diagnosis. What is this? And I've sat down back to back with child welfare social workers who, 2 separate cases, they come in and they say, well, I've got a woman who's been violent. Well, they're telling me because she's been arrested, right? And the first woman, you talk to the worker, this is a real, really, really happened. And after 5 minutes talking about patterns of behavior and asking questions about the woman's pattern, they say, you're describing her partner's pattern, male partner's pattern. She's a victim. She's just fighting back. I know how to work with her. And they left. Actually, they left the consult. That to them, they just needed permission to think through a pattern-based lens and to realize it's self-defense.
Right.
The next worker, again, totally unplanned, came in and said, I've got a woman who's violent, again, because she was arrested. And we went through the pattern, and she'd used a weapon against her male partner, a gun. She was living with a male partner who was low IQ, so low functioning in terms of intellect. And so she was using that. And the worker observed her ordering him around and controlling his behavior. And so we talked about that. And she'd been violent to a past partner. You know, so we went through that. Now, she may have had a trauma history. She may not have. But in this particular case, based on the information we had, it looked like she was engaging in some form of control towards her partner, who had vulnerabilities. So I think we have to have the ability to kind of to look at those different scenarios and kind of do our best to understand what might be happening in those families.
Absolutely. And to circle back on the language that you used when we transitioned to this topic, this part of the topic was and women using violence in unjustified ways or using force in unjustified ways. And for me, my heart and soul is as a practitioner. And I want to know, I do my best into the programming that I support to enter a space, create a space where we do our best to remove the judgment. And that might sound very curious or to people or may not understand around that. And what I mean by that is that when we're able to encourage people to engage in a journey when they're removing their self-judgment, they're able to take a deeper dive into why they're doing what they're doing. So if she did what she did when she did it, for her, it seemed like a good idea in that moment. And that's what I want to understand for whomever is that space. So first of all, who are the people in the room? What are their experiences? And looking at what happened and thinking in terms of how we can support that person in the future through exploring viable alternatives, but always within a lens of oppression and understand the different things that happen. But if she is using self-defense, no, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about someone who has harmed another person and needs the space to be able to explore what's happening and directions forward. Right.
I think, you know, I'm going to put myself out there as a woman and a person who's got injuries from female perpetration, you know, from childhood. There are women who are very violent. Mm-hmm. There are women who perpetrate coercive control. They still exist in a world where there's trauma. Men exist in a world where there's trauma. Although men may have more power and control societally still than women, there are men who are highly oppressed and who don't have as much power and control. So when we dip down into a conversation about trauma-driven violence, I actually don't have a lot of, how can I say it, patience for the narrative that we can be extra understanding about that. I do feel that we have to face the reality that what that means is that we have to be able to work with somebody behaviorally to separate out their trauma from the current situation that they're living in and speak to them about what is behaviorally healthy, what is behaviorally acceptable under the rubrics of the law in any given region, what is behaviorally supportive to a connected, healthy relationship, what is behaviorally supportive to the cohesion and the well-being of the family and children if they're involved, because everybody has trauma. Everybody has drama who exists in this world.
I'd actually like to reframe it in terms of the women that I've worked with and done research with. They don't use the language of trauma. They use the language of being or feeling broken. And so it is not only possible, but it's essential that from my perspective, that we hold all of these issues. None of them are mutually exclusive, but I'm not in any way saying excusing someone for harm that they have encountered, but I am saying that there needs to be a place for holistically addressing where people are now and where they want to go forward. And it may not be part of what they want for themselves moving forward. It is my obligation to facilitate healing and change as they embark on their future. Yeah. But I do see it as absolutely possible and necessary to holistically address these issues.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Let me go out on a limb and you can tell me if I'm wrong or right, that you might use a very similar approach if you were working with a male who had been violent. And I'm saying that as a statement so you can say yes or no or maybe or it depends. Because I'm listening. I'm just thinking about the translation, about the curiosity, the clarity about a boundary, regardless of the sort of story, ultimately, you know, that's there saying this is not okay behavior. That's what I'm hearing. But maybe I'm mishearing, Lisa, in what you're talking about, or misunderstanding how you'd apply it.
Right. When you asked me, you said whether you're wrong or you're right. And my work, I really strive to go beyond binaries, whether it's victim, offender, whatever it may be, right or wrong. I want to help people be in conflict with themselves so they can do their own best work and where they need to go. And the identities of the, tell me who's in the room, help me understand their histories. But for all of us, you know, this journey of self-acceptance and reconciling with what we've done and what we want to be doing on this planet, all of those things are really important.
It doesn't sound in my ears. I mean, it sounds very similar to when I used to describe my work with men, and most of my work was with men who had been arrested, but I always did work with men who came in, quote unquote, voluntarily, you know, without an arrest. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was always that, that I was often working with their contradictions and between who they said they wanted to be and how they've been acting. And to get them to kind of make their own changes. And I think some people were uncomfortable with that. I think some people want the carceral system to guarantee cessation, right? But it was always a sense of, I'm talking to you, I have no ability to stop you from being violent. You have the ability to stop yourself. And there was always we'd always set a clear boundary about unacceptable behavior. But we often brought the same curiosity you're describing. I often brought the same curiosity to the work with the men that I think you're describing in the work you're doing with women who use force.
Yes. And I think that battering intervention and men's behavior change work can learn a lot from the work that I'm doing and that I'm encouraging. And I don't in any way want to separate this from a systems perspective. We're talking very interpersonally right now in our interactions with people in the group environment, but we're all existing in social systems of race, class, gender, ethnicity, a whole range of identities that shape how institutions respond to us and the privileges that we do and don't have.
Isn't it interesting that we've existed in this extremely siloed reality when it comes to responding to these things, but people really haven't internalized and gotten that each of us has our own role and we have our own thing that we need to do in order to facilitate this change, where your focus is really on the behavioral, you know, realities and helping to facilitate that healing. You know, some people may scream, you should throw them into jail, lock them up. Some people do need to be in jail. Some people are truly a threat to themselves and to others, and they're unwilling to change. But we each have a role as a professional to help to look at where we are in the system and say, what is my job to facilitate the change, to facilitate creating more safety, to facilitate more safe and healthy connection? What can I do in the role that I play rather than looking at each other in conflict and really getting that, really internalizing that?
But I think we also really, it's imperative, at least in my work, to really address how powerful the legal system is. And I mean that it goes without saying, but it must be said. And that in the work that I do, our language is saturated with it. Our view on what's possible is saturated with it. I truly believe we need more community-based responses where intervention providers are asserting their role and their perspectives and their expertise, their lived experience in this work and also in relationships, rather than continually relying on a legal system that is set up through a punishment lens rather than, people, if there are, like you were saying, Ruth, you know, there are times when we need that kind of help. But also, I think we're too reliant on it right now.
I 100% agree with you, and I feel like the system that's set up does not actually fit for very specific groups of people, and those very specific groups of people, like Latin, Hispanic, Black, Indigenous people, non-binary people, LGBTQ people, are hesitant, system hesitant, to enter into any contact with the system, leaving them essentially deserted for any type of assistance, because all assistance is funneled through those carceral systems, through contact with police, through mandates, through courts, where really, truly, if we were concerned about human relationships and children and families, we would remember that we all have a role to play in talking about what it is that supports those healthy connections, what it is that creates a healthy relationship, what it is that supports families and the development of children.
I do want to build on what you're saying, also respond to what you're saying. I mentioned the research with 33 women that I spent the 3 years with. And my book, the results from that, is coming out later this year. The name is Broken: Women's Stories of Intimate and Institutional Harm and Repair. And it really goes into detail in terms of these women's experience with child protection, anti-violence intervention, and life after, and life on probation as well. And I want to point out that there are people in these systems who are so dedicated to change, and they're there because they want to facilitate the kind of change that we believe in and we're talking about here. But many of us are find barriers in that change process, whether we're in the, you know, the legal system, or in child protection or anti-violence intervention settings. So it's so important that we collectively continue to push forward in a way that is truly holistically responsive to the needs of people.
So can you talk a little, Lisa, about, you mentioned 9 themes earlier, just the kind of a couple or a few of them that are the most prominent for you or came forward the strongest in the research in terms of your listening to and hearing these women's stories, both of their own use yes. of force and the system and all those things.
I want to be clear, though, with that, I was not listening in that. We were looking at secondary intake assessment data. So it's how the okay. women themselves wrote down and described
okay.
The incident that led to their arrest. And there were actually a number of incidents where they were falsely accused. There was gaslighting and coercive control happening. And what I later referred to in my dissertation research and in work that I'm working on now, something I refer to as the arrest web. Police arrive, maybe in this case, it's a heterosexual cis couple, and he actually gaslights the police into believing that she is the one that has harmed him, and she's arrested because he has physical proof on his body that that allegedly he's been harmed by her. And this may have happened in these cases, happened through him. After he abused her, he then self-inflicted wounds on himself. So it looked to the responding officers like he was the victim in these cases. And it's very, very difficult with the way that police response is set up in terms of the police around the police interview and what happens. And if you don't have any experience with the police, it's your first time, and you're told, okay, what happened? You're asked what happened. Many women explain, this is in my dissertation research, they would tell me, I didn't feel safe enough to talk about it right then, so I waited till I was in the police car, even if they were separated in the house, not understanding that if they made it to the police car, they were arrested and it was too late. So this is, you know, not only the 9 themes, the 9 themes have built on, they're the basis for work, of course, that has come later. I think it's important for us to understand the complexity around this. And I had mentioned also women who had harmed their partners who were not currently abusive, but they had histories of surviving harm. So through anticipatory use of force, some women had chosen to stay with partners who had abused them in the past, but had not recently been abusive, and then responded that way. So there was really a whole range of information. And I'm happy to, I know a lot of times it's hard for practitioners to get a hold of research. So people are welcome to contact me and I can send you any of that.
It's fascinating. You know, the you know, one is I know that people don't know the domestic violence field who might be listening. I don't know who that is. I mean, but just the gaslighting you're describing. And I think those are the stories that people go, somebody really does that? And go, yes, they do. They abuse and do. They hurt themselves. They scratch themselves. They slap themselves. They do other things to create injuries. And then they show. I mean, I remember working on a case where he brought her alcohol when she wasn't supposed to be drinking and gave it to her and then agitated her and worked her up. And then when she responded drunkenly, violently to him, he takes out his phone and starts videotaping her. And it's you know, about gaslighting, it's blackmail, it's about entrapment. And and so these scenarios, you know, really, really resonate. And I think I like the term arrest web. And I think it's sort of understanding, you know, that systems, we actually, one of my themes recently in some of my work is how the risk assessment framework is so much looking at these variables that relate to the people and not to the system most of the time, you know, and so they don't assess the system and the risks that might be generated by the system or the failures of the system or something, but they're often looking at, well, this person's suicidal. I mean, legitimate stuff to be looking at.
Yes.
But often an incomplete story. And so I think for me, one of the takeaways is just you really emphasizing that you can't understand women's use of force into a relationship separate from maybe their partner or their history, but also the system, right? Is that sort of a fair summary of what you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, absolutely about context.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I mean, and I think context matters so much. So help me understand, you know, again, I'm going to ask you a question and I know you're going to say it's too black and white, and then you're going to kind of break it down for us. So this, I know, is going, but that's okay. But you know, it's you know, the statement gets made, and I'm on Twitter, unfortunately, a lot, and talking, and you know, and you get people say, well, domestic violence isn't gendered, right? That's the statement that gets made. Domestic violence has no gender. You know, all domestic violence is bad, and it has echoes of All Lives Matters, right? And in fact, that's kind of one of the points of reference I use in my book, but. What's your response when people say either on either end of the spectrum, domestic violence is gendered, period. Domestic violence isn't gendered, period. What do you say to those statements from both those perspectives?
Well, I had said a few minutes ago that part of my work was putting people in conflict with themselves in order to figure out their best way forward.
Right.
So I'm not here to be at odds with anyone. I'm here based on here, meaning in this work.
Yeah.
I'm doing very centered work through the experiences of people who lived it, and I've walked alongside of them. So I think from my understanding of this question and this binary that you've presented me. that I think that
respectfully is, and gently, hopefully respectfully, yes, and gently, yes, just sort of an educative, like it's meant to like give you a chance to speak and,
yes,
and talk about it.
I appreciate very much what I see is a move toward, I believe, the best possible motivation of looking toward inclusivity, to say that everyone can be harmed. Absolutely, they can. But I am concerned about how inclusivity can then become the erasure of experience, and it can become neutrality.
Right.
I don't think anybody really wants that. And I think that when we sit with people and we hear their experiences, we start understanding how the bodies they travel in are responded to differently from different people from different systems, and how their embodied experiences are very different across spectrums. And I want to understand that. So rather than including, you know, encouraging another binary, I hope that people will do their own work. I hope that people will appreciate and understand what Black feminist theory has taught us through intersectionality. And it's a very powerful lens. And again, rather than neutrality, I'm looking, you know, true inclusivity is taking a deep dive into people's experience. So how is that for
comparison? Any answer was going to be good. I was just playing the role of the interviewer.
I like this interplay.
Yeah, no, I just, because you and I both know that those statements are out there. They get made.
Absolutely.
And I have to deal with them. You have to deal with them. You have your response. I have my response. And again, sort of in the spirit, there's no wrong or right answer from my perspective with it. It's absolutely. Just sort of, and I resonate with you in terms of, you know, that I think some of this is answered at the level of experience. I think we can step. And I would always say, when I first started the work, you know, 45 years ago, 30, 40 years ago, whatever it is now, you know, I started doing work in child protection, moving from a system where we're doing men's behavior change and having a background in feminist theory and understanding this through a gender lens and male violence against women, and going to move with the government state where you had an obligation. And I felt this, by the way, personally, that government has a responsibility to be neutral and non-prejudging people based on race, class, gender, sexual orientation, anything like that, right? And that we everybody deserves that objectivity in the sense of, I'm going to look at this case without prejudgment. But prejudgment, non-prejudgment doesn't mean you forget everything you know about the world and dynamics and the dynamics of domestic violence. But I said to folks, we can trust that if we ask the right questions about coercive control and we ask the right questions about harm and patterns, which is the best of what we can figure out, and we can think about entrapment, and we can think about the difference between controlling somebody without ever hitting them, and understand the nature of those experiences, and listen, whether it's reading a report or talking to survivors, listen to survivors of all backgrounds, and you'll hear, you know, both, you know, men who are being, you know, on the side of it, you'll hear men saying, she attacked me, I held her off, but I was never scared of her. And that's critical to me, right? And I'm not saying there aren't men out there who don't get scared of their partners, because if she uses a weapon or they're smaller or they're disabled or they're, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't happen.
Right.
But I heard over and over again from men I worked with that they said they didn't experience fear. Now, I'm not saying their partner's behavior was okay or legal. Like, arrest that person if they broke a law. Like, do that. But don't tell me that's exactly the same experience as somebody who is pinned against the wall, is afraid, can't move, and is worried they're going to die. Those two experiences are dramatically different, and they are often shaped by the bodies somebody's in. So, so that's, I don't know. Does that feel reflecting back to you what you were saying before and stepping away from?
I appreciate that, David. Yes.
Okay. Good. I just wanted to make sure. You know, but I think it's good for the listeners to hear this, because I think it does go past the binary, and that's what I was hoping to do by asking you the question. And get people thinking about these things. Right. I think it's important to get past the polemics and the jargon and to sort of say, look, there are women who use force in ways that deeply hurt, entrap, and harm male partners or female partners, right? And that's real. It exists. But that guy who's holding somebody off and then turning around saying, look at her, she's just as bad as I am after he strangled her and she almost died. We can't fall into that trap as those things are equal. They're just not.
Yes.
And this takes contextual, this takes contextualizing, you know, the thing that you love to do. It takes contextualization. It takes understanding the situation of the person who's in that experience.
Yes.
And their power, what their power is and what the power and control of the other person is.
And the system
response to that, the historical system response to that. You know, and I just want to land us again in a couple of different realities. And that is that violence is a human experience. It is part of our existence here in this world, whether we agree with it existing or not, it does. And that at the end of the day, all of our responsibility is to be able to reflect back the experiences of violence and say, where was this violence applied in a way which was self-protective? And where was this violence applied in a way which was meant to harm, meant to create fear, and meant to control? And the only way we can do that is by understanding the context of the experience.
Mm-hmm. And that's, thank you for that, Ruth. And with the language of self-protective, oftentimes women, and this was part of that research, but also part of my practice, would come saying, I did what I did out of self-defense. And when they detail to me what happened, I know that in no way would it align with the legal system defense, legal system definition of self-defense. That's why as a practitioner, I grew to understand it meant defense of self. Like I couldn't take it anymore.
Our dignity, but, human yes. dignity.
Right. And that's, it was actually theme is asserting dignity.
Right.
Because they would not, they could not, they decided that the coercive control, everything else, weren't going to do it. And I want to respond also to something else about the example, the great example you gave, and pointing out that she was in fear. I think it's also important for people in our work to recognize that oftentimes, if a woman is in a relationship where she's using resistive violence, she will not identify to practitioners as a survivor or victim or as in fear. As a coping skill, a survival skill. Say, no, I'm not. That's why it's so important when we're doing thorough assessments, what behaviorally was happening days or hours, days, weeks, months before the incident, because oftentimes for her, that's not the incident. That's not the incident. It's so much more.
You know, I'm trained as a mental health professional, mm-hmm. and I think that the psychological approach has come to kind of dominate a lot of the conversations and the sort of focus on emotions. And if somebody doesn't say they're afraid, they fall out of that category that you talk about being the good victim, the binary, the good victim. And it's for so many reasons. It's not survivors. They don't want to say that they're not recognizing it. They don't feel it. It's they're angry. They're a lot of their personal awareness is over a lot of things. But that we don't look at their behaviors. I think and this is the context of protection. Somebody saying to me, well, she's not protecting her kids. I said, well, describe to me mm-hmm. what she's doing, what actions she's taking to protect her mm-hmm. kids. Right. So this is all about, you know, we're talking about violence and women's use of force, but it's really about a continuum of behaviors, right? We're really discussing yes. and we talk about mm-hmm. resistance or protection. And well, she's put on security cameras on her house and she's got an alarm system and to make sure he doesn't come over. And, you know, they describe all these very protective behaviors. And I said, so when I hear you describe this, right, you know, my listening is that she's acting very protectively of her kids, that she's taking concrete steps to protect her kids and herself.
Sorry to interrupt. Yeah. I would love somebody to ask that question to the system and professionals.
Yeah. And
so what are the protective behaviors?
But that's what I said. I said, what do you want her to be doing or saying that she's not? Mm-hmm. And the very immediate explicit one, I want her to be saying she's afraid.
Mm-hmm. There it is.
Uh-huh. I want her to say she's afraid. And it was so...
Let me grovel for you.
Well, right. It was so narrow and so specific. And this was the only appropriate good behavior that she can engage in. If she didn't, and this could have led to the removal, I don't know what ultimately happened, the removal of her kids. She didn't do the good victim behavior that was expected. Right. Mm-hmm. So I think acts of resistance, violent acts of resistance, nonviolent acts of resistance, acts of protection, we need to get so much better at understanding. And understanding requires that context you've been talking about.
Right. Yes. In addition to that good victim, there's the whole idea and stereotype around the good mother is very, very powerful. And it's just our so many cultures are really soaked in what that is without even an awareness.
Right. Well, the good mother both won't allow somehow the violence to happen, even though somebody else is choosing to do it. And the good mother will also not respond to it. So what exactly is a good mother in those circumstances? It's absolutely appalling when you break it down in those terms.
Well, there's no,
you know, somebody's standing over you, screaming at you, demeaning you, spitting on you, and you cannot respond, but you're still a bad mother because the children are seeing that happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's absolutely crazy making. That's insane. Yeah.
So We would love to be talking to you more, but we have to kind of find a way to wrap up and discuss. We may have you back on the show. This is one of those sort of such a rich conversation, and you're such a I think such a clear and innovative and kind of thoughtful person in the field. You know, so thinking about this, I really appreciate your research and your practitioner role. That there's a depth there that you sort of really care about the people who you're working with, who you're trying to understand, and then bring out their experience out through your research. And that's giving a platform. We're hoping we've been giving you a platform to talk about that. To wrap up, you know, let's start with professionals. You know, talking about women's use of force on this show for 45 minutes or an hour, what do you want professionals to take away from your work or this conversation?
From the conversation, I hope that you'll do really the personal work that is so necessary to do in terms of your own judgments, own ideas around why we do this work and what you want to see happen, and challenge binary thinking in yourself and in the places where you work, and asserting our role in terms of holistically addressing the complexities of people's lives. I think we've got to do better than that, rather than responding to legal systems rules, responding to child protection. I understand that there are a range of systems and structures put into place, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they're working. And so continue to be radically curious and both of yourself and the people in the room, because they need us.
Okay, great. That's a great message. And what would you want, because we do get survivors listening to the show, what do you want them to take away from this conversation?
I hope that you'll take away that you're not alone. There is work that I'm doing in a range of countries and locations, and be able to connect with other people and to support you. And I hope so much that we can continue to do work in a way that you do feel heard, and we are changing systems.
And I'm going to ask what you want people who are using violence to take away from this conversation.
I hope that they will take the opportunity to reflect on what's happening now and what they want to be happening, what they want to see happen in the future, and seek the necessary support in making that happen.
Great. Thank you. Is there a website or any resources you want to direct folks to now?
My personal website is lisayounglaurance.com. There's also my where I'm very proud to be an assistant professor of social work and social research at the Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research at Bryn Mawr College. And yeah, those would be two great places to start. And thank you so much for the work that you're doing, David and Ruth. It's really been my privilege.
Yeah, thank you. I'm honored to have you on the show. So that's another great podcast. I always hate when these stop sometimes.
I want to keep talking.
We have
You've got a lot more to say.
We have a lot more to say. But anyway, we'll have to have you back on the show. But thank you all who are out there been listening. I'm David Mandel, CEO of the Safer Together Institute.
And I'm still Ruth Raimondo Mandel.
And if you want to learn more about the Safer Together Institute, you can go to safertogetherinstitute.com, or if you want to take our e-learning, go to academy.safertogetherinstitute.com.
And we're out.
And we're out.